Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. 1801. I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbour that I shall be troubled with. This is certainly a beautiful country. In all England, I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthropist's heaven. And Mr. Heathcliff and I are such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us. A capital fellow. He little imagined how my heart warmed towards him when I beheld his black eyes withdraw so suspiciously under their brows as I rode up, and when his fingers sheltered themselves with a jealous resolution still further in his waistcoat as I announced my name. "Mr. Lockwood, your new tenant, sir, at Thrushcross Grange." "Walk in," he uttered with closed teeth. "Joseph, take Mr. Lockwood's horse and bring up some wine." Joseph was an elderly man, nay, an old man, though hale and sinewy. "The Lord help us," he soliloquised in an undertone of peevish displeasure at my unexpected advent. Wuthering Heights is the name of Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling. Wuthering being a significant provincial adjective, descriptive of the atmospheric tumult to which its station is exposed in stormy weather. One may guess the power of the north wind blowing over the edge by the excessive slant of a few stunted firs at the end of the house. Happily, the architect had foresight to build it strong. The narrow windows are deeply set in the wall, and the corners defended with large jutting stones. One step brought us into the family sitting room without any introductory lobby or passage. The apartment and furniture would have been nothing extraordinary as belonging to a homely northern farmer, but Mr. Heathcliff forms a singular contrast to his abode and style of living. He is a dark-skinned gypsy in aspect, in dress and manners a gentleman. That is, as much a gentleman as many a country squire. Rather slovenly, perhaps, yet not looking amiss with his negligence, because he has an erect and handsome figure, and rather morose. I took a seat at the end of the hearthstone, opposite that towards which my landlord advanced, and filled up an interval of silence by attempting to caress the canine member of the household. My caress provoked a long, guttural snarl. Heathcliff's countenance relaxed into a grin at my reception by the animal. "Here, take a little wine. Guests are so exceedingly rare in this house that I and my dogs hardly know how to receive them. Your health, sir." I bowed and returned the pledge. Beginning to perceive that it would be foolish to sit sulking for the misbehaviour of a cur. Besides, I felt loath to yield the fellow amusement at my expense, since his humour took that turn. But my host then relaxed further and introduced what he supposed would be a subject of interest to me, a discourse on the advantages and disadvantages of my present place of retirement. I found him very intelligent on the topics we touched, and before I went home, I was encouraged so far as to volunteer another visit tomorrow. But he evidently wished no repetition of my intrusion. I shall go, notwithstanding. Yesterday afternoon set in misty and cold. I had half a mind to spend it by my study fire, instead of wading through heath and mud to Wuthering Heights. However, I arrived at Heathcliff's garden gate just in time to escape the first feathery flakes of a snow shower. I knocked vainly for admittance till my knuckles tingled and the dog howled. Vinegar-faced Joseph projected his head from a round window of the barn. "Is there nobody inside to open the door?" I hallooed responsively.
"There's nobody but missus," muttered the head, vanishing.
The snow began to drive thickly. I seized the handle to essay another trial, when a young man without coat, a servant evidently, and shouldering a pitchfork, appeared in the yard behind, and hailed me to follow him. In the huge, warm, cheerful apartment where I was formerly received, I was pleased to observe the Mrs., an individual whose existence I had never previously suspected. I bowed and waited, thinking she would bid me to take a seat. She looked at me, leaning back in her chair, and remained motionless and mute. She was slender and apparently scarcely past girlhood, an admirable form, and the most exquisite little face that I have ever had the pleasure of beholding. Small features, very fair, flaxen ringlets.
"Sit down," said the young man gruffly. "He'll be in soon."
I obeyed, but began to doubt whether he were a servant or not. His dress and speech were both rude, entirely devoid of the superiority observable in Mr. and Mrs. Heathcliff. His thick brown curls were rough and uncultivated, his whiskers encroached bearishly over his cheeks, and his hands were embrowned like those of the common labourer. Still, his bearing was free, almost haughty, and he showed none of a domestic's assiduity in attending on the lady of the house. The entrance of Heathcliff caused tea to be served to us, and relieved the silence somewhat, and we all, including the rustic youth, drew round the table. "It is strange," I began, in the interval of swallowing one cup of tea and receiving another, "it is strange how custom can mould our tastes and ideas. Many could not imagine the existence of happiness in a life of such complete exile from the world as you spend, Mr. Heathcliff. Yet I'll venture to say that surrounded by your family and with your amiable lady as the presiding genius over your house and hearth..." "My amiable lady," he interrupted, with an almost diabolical sneer on his face. "Where is she, my amiable lady?"
"Mrs. Heathcliff.
Your wife, I mean."
"Oh, you would intimate that her spirit has taken the post of ministering angel and guards the fortunes of Wuthering Heights even when her body is gone. Is that it?"
Perceiving myself in a blunder, I attempted to correct it. I might have seen that there was too great a disparity between the ages of the parties to make it likely that they were man and wife. One was about 40, the other did not look 17. Then it flashed upon me. The clown at my elbow may be her husband, Heathcliff Junior, of course.
"Mrs. Heathcliff's my daughter-in-law," said Heathcliff, corroborating my surmise.
"Ah, certainly, I see now. You are the favoured possessor of the beneficent fairy," I remarked, turning to my neighbour. This was worse than before. The youth grew crimson and clenched his fist with every appearance of a meditated assault.
"Unhappy in your conjectures, sir," observed my host. "We neither of us have the privilege of owning your good fairy. Her mate is dead. I said she was my daughter-in-law, therefore she must have married my son."
"And this young man is
not my son, assuredly." "My name is Hareton Earnshaw," growled the other, "and I'd counsel you to respect it."
The business of eating being concluded, and no one uttering a word of sociable conversation, I approached the window to examine the weather. A sorrowful sight I saw, dark night coming down prematurely, and sky and hills mingled in one bitter whirl of wind and suffocating snow.
"I don't think it possible for me to get home now without a guide," I could not help exclaiming. "The roads will be buried already, and if they were bare, I could scarcely distinguish a foot in advance."
"There is no one here to guide you home."
"Then it follows that I am compelled to stay."
"I hope it will be a lesson to you to make no more rash journeys on these hills," cried Heathcliff. "As to staying here, I don't keep accommodation for visitors."
"I can sleep on a chair in this room," I replied.
"No, No, it will not suit me to permit anyone the range of the place while I am off guard, said the unmannerly wretch. With no further welcome than this, I was obliged to spend the night at Wuthering Heights. When the rest of the house had retired, it was left to Zillah, the stout housewife, to find me a place to sleep. While leading the way upstairs, she recommended that I should hide the candle and not make a noise, for her master had an odd notion about the chamber she would put me in, and never let anybody lodge there willingly. I asked the reason. She did not know, she answered. She had only lived there a year or two, and they had so many queer goings on, she could not begin to be curious. Too stupefied to be curious myself, I fastened my door and prepared for bed. The window ledge above the bed where I placed my candle was covered with writing, scratched on the paint. A name, repeated in all kinds of characters, large and small. A Catherine Earnshaw. Here and there varied to Catherine Heathcliff, and then again to Catherine Linton. In vapid listlessness, I leant my head against the window and continued spelling over Catherine Earnshaw, Heathcliff, Linton, till my eyes closed. But they had not rested 5 minutes when I was disturbed by the noise from the branch of a fir tree that touched my lattice as the wind wailed by and rattled its dry cones against the panes. I resolved to silence it if possible. I endeavoured to unhasp the casement, but the hook was soldered into the staple. I must stop it, nevertheless, I muttered, knocking my knuckles through the glass and stretching an arm out to seize the branch, instead of which my fingers closed on the fingers of a little ice-cold hand. The intense horror of nightmare came over me. I tried to draw back my arm, but the hand clung to it, and a most melancholy voice sobbed, "Let me in! Let me in!" "Who are you?" I asked, struggling meanwhile to disengage myself.
"Catherine Linton," it replied shiveringly. "I'm come home. I've lost my way on the moor."
As it spoke, I discerned obscurely a child's face looking through the window. Terror made me cruel, and finding it useless to attempt shaking the creature off, I pulled its wrist onto the broken pane and rubbed it to and fro till the blood ran down and soaked the bedclothes. Still it wailed,
"Let me in,"
and maintained its tenacious grip, almost maddening me with fear. "How can I?" I said at length. "Let me go, if you want me to let you in." The fingers relaxed. I snatched mine through the hole and stopped my ears to exclude the lamentable prayer. I seemed to keep them closed above a quarter of an hour, yet the instant I listened again, there was the doleful cry moaning on. "Begone," I shouted. "I'll never let you in, not if you beg for 20 years.
"It is 20 years, mourned the voice. 20 years. I've been a waif for 20 years.
Thereat began a feeble scratching outside. I tried to jump up, but could not stir a limb, and so yelled aloud in a frenzy of fright. Hasty footsteps approached my chamber door. Somebody pushed it open with a vigorous hand. Heathcliff stood with a candle dripping over his fingers, and his face as white as the walls around him.